Is the Brazilian miracle over? Or did it ever even really get off the ground for most Brazilians?
While it's true that a lot of people can afford things that they could not afford before, you see people with smartphones all over the place, a lot more Brazilians have cars now, things like that, material things. What has not changed is who really holds power, who actually is tapping onto the big sources of money in the country. That has not changed.
That's Juliana Barbassa. We go to Rio with her to take a pulse of Brazilian society, the forces holding it back, and the people's push for more democracy. Her book is Dancing with the Devil in the City of God. Then Ta-Nehisi Coates just got a MacArthur Genius Grant Award. We re-air our 28 interview with him about his memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. We re-air our 2008 interview with him about his memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. As we're putting together this week's show, Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff faces impeachment as her government is rocked by scandal and her country's economy struggles in recession. It wasn't supposed to be like that. In 2009, Brazil was the first Latin American country to be chosen to host the Olympic Games, slated for Rio in 2016. It was an indication that the country had arrived as a major player on the world stage. But even back then, serious questions were raised about Rio's readiness to host the Games. Questions about violence from criminal gangs, rampant corruption, and pollution from uncontrolled development. In her beautifully reported book, Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, my guest, Juliana Barbassa, reveals the cracks in the Brazilian miracle, taking her native city, Rio, as the example. She writes about epic battles between police and gangs, the resistance put up by poor communities to being swept away by development, and the ecological disaster that threatens Rio's fabled beaches. Barbassa was born in Brazil, but spent much of her life away from her native land. She remembered it fondly, but from afar. Then she noticed that a country that usually only made headlines around Carnival started to be featured more and more in global news. All of a sudden, Brazil was not just the homeland she'd been away from so long. It was a story begging for her to cover. She got her chance in 2010 when the AP sent her to Rio to be its correspondent.
So in addition to my sort of lifelong interest in Brazil as a Brazilian abroad, who always halfway longed to be there, halfway, had a foot there, no matter where I was actually living. I also became very interested as a journalist because I could see this was a crucial moment. A country was trying to leverage itself onto a different realm, and it was going to welcome the World Cup in 2014 and then the Olympics in 2016. So it was trying to go through this big change at a moment when it was also inviting the world to come and look and see how much it had grown and all of, the positive transformations that had gone on. So I could tell that, it was going to be tight, and it was going to be very interesting, not just for me, but for the world, for people looking in from the outside. And I wanted to be there to tell that story.
You went there just after the announcement that Brazil had been awarded the 2016 Olympics. One of the things that Lula, who was the president at the time, promised the Olympic Committee was that Rio would be safe for the Olympic Games. Why was that an issue?
Well, Rio de Janeiro's reputation has been for a very long time that of a dangerous city. And I have to say, as somebody who was there, visited, and I lived there for a brief period in the 80s, that reputation was well-deserved during the 1980s and the 1990s in particular. There was a lot of pickpocketing, petty crime in the streets. Brazilians driving wouldn't stop at a red light after 10 p.m., for example, out of fear of being carjacked. And so this was a very real, very concrete concern if you're talking about hosting a major international event. And Brazil and Rio had to show that they were already doing something to deal with this, not just the reputation, but the fact of criminality in Rio. And they were. Rio had this innovative, never attempted before in the city program that had as one of its goals bringing down the levels of crime in the city. This program was putting police officers into very specific favelas, which are low-income communities, many of them which have been taken over by drug dealers, by drug dealing gangs, and essentially abandoned by the state for a very long time. So now police was going into these areas, occupying them, establishing round-the-clock presence, and in doing so, basically eliminating this safe zone for people who could go commit crimes in the city at large and then, you know, hide back in these areas. So they didn't just promise that they would deal with it. They were actually implementing a program that was, for the first time in over 20 years, trying to tackle this very serious issue. And that was one of the questions that I had when I came back is, will this work? What are the costs of this program? Not even financially, but speaking in terms of the life of the people who live in these communities, who I figured would be affected pretty intensely by this round-the-clock, you know, policing effort. What would it mean for the city at large? Would Rio be able to pull this off in a satisfactory way? And it's one of the things that I deal with in the book. I feel like it's an unfolding issue, but I could see, even in 2014, which is when the book ends, that a lot of this was already starting to come unraveled, unfortunately. A lot of these expectations were failing to produce the anticipated, the much hoped for results.
One of the most interesting aspects of this book is how it looks at how difficult it is, really, for a society to change. We think of Brazil now as a place, and it is, of tremendous development, of rising standards of living, and yet institutional structures also hold it back. Give us the overview of where Brazil has come from in the 21 years you were away, and what's changed and what's remained the same.
Well, it's very interesting because Brazil has changed a lot, or not at all, depending on who you are and where you're standing. It has changed a lot. As somebody who, again, the last time that I lived in Brazil was in the mid-80s. So Brazil was transitioning from a military regime to a democracy. The economy was roller-coastering all over the place. During this period of tremendous flux, there was hyperinflation. People couldn't plan their lives. You know, people couldn't make it. The majority of Brazilians could not make ends meet and had doubts about how they were going to feed themselves at the end of the month. Very, very difficult circumstances. And so if you look at that Brazil, if you lived that Brazil, and you see Brazil now with a substantial middle class, yes, middle class that's being increasingly squeezed by, you know, hiking interest rates, by increasing inflation again, but it's a middle class that's there, a middle class that's often out in the streets, has been, you know, for various reasons over the past couple of years, making demands of its government. The quality of life for most Brazilians has improved very much in this last 20 years or so, 20, 25 years or so. So if you look at it that way, it's a tremendous change. What has not changed, and what I think is equally important, is, as you said, the underpinning structures. While it's true that for a lot of people can afford things that they could not afford before, you see people with smartphones all over the place, a lot more Brazilians have cars now, things like that, material things. What has not changed is who really holds power, who actually is tapping onto the big sources of money in the country. That has not changed. There's a lot of hope that that would change when the Workers' Party came into power, which happened in the early 2000s. And that party did bring a lot of policies that benefited Brazilians who had never seen the government do anything for them, i.e. the poorest classes. But unfortunately, the the biggest structures of power were not shaken, and that's the part that's most disappointing in this big transformation. I had hoped for a deeper shift that would really realign the power structures. That is a lot to hope for, as you said. These are big questions. How does a society change? And one of the answers that we got out of Brazil is even a big political change, even putting the representative of the working class in power for the first time in Brazil's history did not make the change go deep enough. There's a lot there. So
you say, Juliana Barbosa, you say in Dancing with the Devil in the City of God that Brazil is being judged not only by its GDP, but also by its record on human rights, equality, justice, environmental sustainability, and quality of life. Let's start with human rights. You mentioned the military regime. That was a dictatorship. It was overthrown. Democracy came in. What's the status of human rights now?
Well, this is one of the big disappointments, as I mentioned. One would hope that, 20 years into, over 20 years now, gosh, but, several decades into a democracy, and with, as I mentioned, this more substantial middle class, we would see things like better human rights conditions, people who are the most vulnerable and most disenfranchised being treated a little bit better. And we're not seeing that. The police is still very lethal. The police in Brazil in general and in Rio de Janeiro it's hard to explain this to Americans, but a lot of Brazilians are afraid of the police. I saw a survey that 60% of Brazilians are afraid, actually, of the police force in their town. In 2007, which was the most lethal year for the police in Rio, the state police of Rio de Janeiro killed about 1,330 people. The police themselves did. And so when you talk about human rights, you're talking about things like this as well. The way the state treats its own most vulnerable population. And unfortunately, we have not seen a change that's deep enough. Just to give one more example, once Rio was awarded the right to host the Olympics, less than 2 months after that announcement came out, Rio's mayor published a list of 119 favelas that would be razed before the Olympics came to Rio. And so 119 communities, if you think about how many families are involved in that. And this was just published in the newspaper. He gave an interview about this. These people were not told. There were no city agents to go there to talk to them, to explain to them personally what this is going to mean for them. They just learned from the news that from one day to the next, their houses are going to be destroyed, their community is going to be razed, and they don't know what's coming next. When I talk about human rights, I mean things like that as well. The way that the poorest are treated by their own government. We have not seen a real change in that in Brazil, and that's most unfortunate.
You went to talk with some of the residents. Well, you spent a fair amount of time in some of the favelas, the poor communities of Rio, but one of them was Metro. They organized to prevent this displacement. What was your experience of the residents and their fight, and what happened?
I spent a lot of time in these favelas because I felt like they are one of the places where you can really judge whether this transformation that Brazil was going through, there's a lot of talk about this transformation that Brazil was going through. The favelas were one of the places where you could really see if this was really happening or not, or how deep it really was going. And, as I mentioned, the way that these announcements were made, the way that the residents were treated as officials came in to say they have to leave, the options that they were given. I mean, many laws were violated. There were a lot of legal issues involved in that. But to me, at the core of it is this continuing disrespect, not just for the legal rights, but the civil rights, the human rights of the poorest. And that's very revealing of where the country is. But also equally revealing, I felt, is the fact that many of these communities are organizing in a way that they haven't before. Removals happened in Brazil. Removals of favelas happened in Brazil and in Rio de Janeiro in particular, also in the 60s and 70s. And there was very little that communities could do back then to push back. And now you see communities like Mitro, like Vila Autódromo, another one that I talk about, and several others that did a wonderful job of coming together, of organizing, of tapping the media, of getting out there on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, and telling their story, working also with nonprofits in Rio that are now very well entrenched and very much in connection with these communities. So the atmosphere, the environment in which these violations happen is different. And there's more, to use a very often used word in these contexts, but they're more empowered. And that was one of the most interesting things that I saw in Brazil. That was one of the instances of real change that, you know, made me feel like, okay, you know, I didn't come back for nothing. This something interesting is really going on.
So the revolution of rising expectations.
Indeed, exactly.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Juliana Barbosa about her book, Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, Rio de Janeiro on the Brink. The book centers not just around the upcoming Olympics, but also around a number of other sporting events. You mentioned 2007, the Pan American Games. Later, there was the 2014 World Cup. Why are sports events such a good lens for looking at what's going on in Brazil?
Because you can trace, especially because we had three in Rio, right? The Pan American Games, the World Cup, and the Olympics. You can trace the way that this has worked to develop a certain part of town, for example. There was this conscious choice to put most of the Pan American Games infrastructure and the vast majority of the Olympic Games' infrastructure in the western part of Rio, which is also the wealthiest part of Rio. It's the real estate frontier where building, I mean, it's a construction zone now. There's so much happening there. And where really one would argue you don't need more public investment, right? You don't need more public money going there. But when you have these events and you sell them to the population as, you know, very positive for the city, we're going to have visitors, we're going to have tourism dollars, we're going to have the world looking at us, it's going to be good for all of us. And in the meantime, you're funneling a lot of money to these parts of town that are already wealthy, getting even more infrastructure like transit routes, the metro line, when there are other parts of town that really, really need that kind of attention and are not getting it. And, you know, to make things worse in Rio, this part of town that's getting the majority of the infrastructure, the Olympic infrastructure, and also got, you know, the majority of the Pan American Games infrastructure, is a landscape that's also very different from the rest of the city in the sense that it's a very unequal landscape. It's an area that's built very differently from everything else. You've got gated communities and highways, essentially. It's not a pedestrian-friendly area. It's concentrated around areas of exclusivity. And, you know, Rio is already an unequal city. It has that reputation, and it is very much so, in fact. So you're only fostering more development, a very unequal model of a very unequal lifestyle and urban development model. So it's very negative for the city. And looking at the sports events and the planning around them and the funneling of money that happens around them allows you to see that this is not a coincidence. The same people, the same politicians have been behind bringing these games to Rio de Janeiro. And they are also in close collaboration with these major developers who are building all that infrastructure. So it's a good lens for that reason. It lets you cut through straight to where's the money going, how's it being used, who's benefiting.
Another thing you talk about in this book, Juliana Barbosa, in Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, is the environmental toll that all this development, and specifically the development around all these sports events, is taking. For example, you visit the area of development for the Olympic Games with an ecologist because it's right in the middle of caiman habitat. You went right into the muck there. What's happening to these alligators, these caimans?
Yeah, I loved being able to get in there in the muck with that biologist and go essentially hunting for alligators with him as a way of talking about how all this development is impacting the environment, because it's so concrete, right? I mean, you see the animals, you see their habitat, and you see the cement encroaching. Again, this very wealthy part of Rio, the west side of Rio, is also caiman, or, you know, a cousin of the alligator habitat. And as it grows very, very fast, often with very little concern for the environment, very little, few impact studies that really count, there's a tremendous clash of this natural environment with this, man-made environment. And you literally have these crocodilians right next to high-end million-dollar penthouses, and the residents coming down in their fancy workout gear and heading out to the beach and checking out the biologists and they're working with the alligators. You can see how these things are pushing against each other in a very concrete, understandable way. And you can also see, one of my pet peeves, one of the things I really try to focus on too, is how poor the sewerage situation is in Rio. And when you have such fast development in an area with such poor existing infrastructure, and this is expensive infrastructure to put into place, you have essentially sewage that ends up in rivers and lakes and in the ocean. And the looking at the crocodilians, at these caimans, lets you talk about, the very concrete impact that this has. And plus, it's really fun. You get to be in there with the alligators.
You followed this river all the way to the source as a way of talking about clean water. And I think this also points out that when habitat is being destroyed for caimans, it's also being destroyed for humans.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to... part of what I really hoped to do with the book is stay away from vague concepts of, it's important to preserve the environment because the future and all of these things, and really get down to just keep your feet on the ground and show the reader specifically what's happening and why it matters, what it looks like, what it smells like. And so, I got in there with the alligators and I followed this river from the feet of the Christ, the iconic Christ statue at the top of this beautifully forested hill in the middle of a national park in Rio, just a couple of miles in down to where it empties into the bay, and how it becomes essentially a sewage canal along the way. So, when you hear these stories about, the water in Rio is polluted, and are the Olympic Games going to be able to be pulled off when, you're going to have sailing in a dirty bay, I wanted to get in there and show people how this happens, and why it becomes this way. And again, I wanted to understand, as a Brazilian, as a person living in Rio and smelling that sewage, I wanted to know how it becomes this way.
Another environmental issue with tragic implications was the clear cutting of forests, which led to devastating mudslides and floods. And again, you went to interview the families. What did you find?
Well, this happened soon after I moved to Rio de Janeiro, and it was one of the most devastating, from a personal perspective, experiences I've ever had, both as a journalist and as an individual. Because, I came back to Rio, and it's a place I care very much about. It's a city where my family lives that I've longed to come back to for a long time. I'm finally reporting in my home language, the language of my childhood and of my family. And one of the very first things that happens after I arrive is this massive disaster where over 1,000 people died. And over a series of days when the rains just wouldn't stop, and they essentially melted these mountains, especially in the areas that had been clear cut and where people had built houses, without... With little planning, with no authorization and no foundations, etc. And so it was a disaster in the making. Anyone who looks at this area can see that. And the thing is, there are many areas like this in Rio, basically waiting for another major storm to liquefy the mountains and bring them crashing down. It talks about the way that, again, it's environmental concerns they're not just there for sort of these vague feel-good reasons. They have very concrete consequences, not just for trees and animals, but for people. We are part of this habitat, and we can be killed as a result of our neglect. It came home to me like a punch, essentially, when I was there for that week.
Going back to the issue of security, you trace the evolution of the gangs that have taken over the favelas. It's a fascinating discussion of how they began during the military dictatorship. Tell us about that evolution and about the government's response to them.
I felt that issue was very complex, and I really wanted to shy away from these black and white portrayals of, you know, the poor favela residents is good and the police is bad, or the drug dealers is bad and the police is good. It's much more complex than that, and it has these very deep roots. And I wanted to trace the origins of this one gang, the biggest gang and the most powerful gang in Rio, in order to understand how they came about, why they came about, and how their growth shaped the city and was shaped by the city in turn. So it was really interesting for me to find, for example, that this gang, it's called the Comando Vermelho in Portuguese, the Red Command in English, that when I came back was terrorizing the city, had originated in prison cells where common criminals were housed alongside political prisoners who were imprisoned because of their opposition to the military government, and who came to prison with a lot of grand ideas about society and things like human rights and civil rights, and basically the strength that there is in unity and coming together and working together for a common cause. And so they brought ideas, they brought books, and they brought techniques to this prison where they shared space with common criminals. And they talked about these things and all of those long hours. And so at its inception, this gang that essentially would later become a criminal gang and, you know, drug dealers, at their origin, they were born out of this, you know, desire for justice, out of this sense that certain people in society, including many of those who were in that prison, never had a fair fighting chance to begin with. You know, a certain set of demands on society. It was really interesting for me to understand that, to see this gang with slightly different eyes. And then obviously bringing it to the present, to understand also how it is that a kid ends up in this gang. You know, I spent some time in one of the big communities, a complex of a series of favelas that are conjoined, that was taken over by police. And I spent time with a former drug dealer that was one of the leaders of this gang, with his mom and with police, trying to understand, you know, how it is that one joins that, how it feels to be the mother of this kid, to watch your kid fall into that, you know, not be able to do much about it, and how it is to be police and to know that whole sections of town are impregnable to you. You can do nothing in there. You can't go in. You're impotent, essentially. So I wanted to show all that and let the reader draw, you know, his or her own conclusions about the situation.
Now, recently there broke this huge scandal, possibly the biggest ever in Brazil's history, involving Petrobras, the state-controlled oil company. Could you briefly give us a sense of what this scandal is about and what its impact has been?
Certainly. And this scandal essentially goes to the heart of what I was mentioning as my biggest disappointment returning to Brazil, which is the fact that the real holders of power and the real holders of the sources of money in Brazil have not changed. Brazil is not a more democratic country, even though there's a greater number of, you know, middle-class people who have greater access to material goods. And this scandal sort of cracks it all open. What it involves is the state-owned oil company at the center, and the government essentially putting people there because the government has the controlling shares of the company. They can nominate the top executives. So the government putting top executives there that are meant to do the government's bidding. thing. And so when a big contract becomes available and can be given to any number of companies, it's assigned to a specific company, and you know that company pays a lot more money than really needs to be paid for that to secure that contract, and part of that money gets kicked back to a government official. And so it's a vicious cycle that defrauds the public, essentially, robs a lot of public money, and fuels it into the hands of powerful business leaders and politicians. And, you know, the Workers' Party was very much involved in this, as were other opposition parties as well. They all took part in it. And so it's, you know, you see the mechanisms of power being cracked open as this investigation is going forth. And it's been fascinating to watch because on the one hand, it's a real disappointment to see that to the degree to which this kind of thing is going on and has gone on in Brazil. But on the other hand, the fact that it's being investigated and prosecuted like it has been, this is absolutely novel. I mean, the size of this scandal is also new, but this kind of thing has gone on for a long time. It wasn't invented during this administration or even the previous. But what is absolutely novel is that there is independent judge looking at it and unfolding phase after phase of this investigation, moving from the oil company to the big construction companies that were given these contracts, and eventually one hopes to the politicians, you know, that form the third leg of this stool, essentially. So this has never happened before. And they're really approaching very, very powerful people. Some of the wealthiest and most powerful businessmen in Brazil are already in jail. This has never happened before. So if there's anything that makes me feel positive about this moment that Brazil is living, it's a very, very difficult moment economically, politically, a lot of instability, people once again unsure about their, you know, their family's financial future. But there, if there's one positive thing coming out of this, is that this is not being treated as just, oh, business as usual. And part of that, I feel, is this sense of greater demand on the part of the Brazilian population. They have given sign after sign that they are not willing to put up with this kind of behavior on the part of their elected officials. Protests, you know, starting before the World Cup and continuing right up until a couple of months ago. So we'll see where it ends, but it does give me some hope.
Well, Juliana Barbosa, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about Brazil and Rio de Janeiro. Your terrific book is Dancing with the Devil in the City of God. Thanks so much.
Thank you so very much.
Juliana Barbosa became AP's Rio de Janeiro correspondent in 2010. Dancing with the Devil in the City of God is her first book. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next up, Ta-Nehisi Coates. Stay tuned after the break.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get them to you, I find the things that I do, you'll make me feel alright. You know I work all day to get your money to buy your things, and it's worth it just to hear you say you're gonna give me everything. So why I love to come home, cause when I get you alone, you know I'll be okay. When I'm I
Welcome back to Writer's Voice on this station and at writersvoice.net. Atlantic Magazine's Ta-Nehisi Coates has been on a tear. He's just been awarded the prestigious MacArthur Fellowship. He's out with an acclaimed new book, a kind of public letter to his teenage son called Between the World and Me, and a terrific new article in The Atlantic on the Black family in the age of mass incarceration. I spoke with him about that book in 2008. Here's an edited version of that interview. Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me.
You grew up in West Baltimore in the 1980s, and you write early in your book, The Beautiful Struggle, that you were in another country than the rest of America. So put us there. Tell us what West Baltimore was like back then.
Well, the thing is, I mean, even though I did say that, what I wanted people to know, you know, was that this is America, too. It's just an America that people don't think about. It's a place in which, and I think this is so true even today for a significant portion of young Black youth, where the most ordinary things, you know, walking around the corner to get the paper, you know, trying to go see your girlfriend, trying to get to school, the specter of violence hangs over all of the smallest daily things. And just how that alters your perception of the world, how it changes you and makes you into something that's completely different than what people normally think about when they think about American childhood.
I asked Ta-Nehisi Coates what it was like for him growing up in Baltimore.
Well, first of all, I want to correct something that's sort of getting out there that I've seen in a couple of reviews, and that is that I grew up poor. I certainly did not grow up poor. I went to school with a lot of kids who did grow up poor, and I know the difference. I, you know, never worried about the clothes on my back, the food, you know, having food to eat or anything like that. You know, most of the book takes place during a period in which I'm living in a community across the street from Baltimore's famous or infamous Mundon Mall. I lived in a brick row house with my mother and with my father. My father had 7 kids by 4 women, so I had 6 other brothers and sisters. And, you know, during different periods, I lived with different brothers and sisters. They were always there, you know, visiting and everything. It was a really, really big family. During the period of discovery, my older brother, Big Bill, who's a character in the book, is living with me, and my younger brother, Menelik, is also living with me. So it's us three, my 2 parents, and occasionally, you know, my sister's home from college or wherever. I think the thing about being Black, though, is that despite not being poor, it's very tough to be African-American and live in an African-American community and not have some sort of acquaintance with poverty, you know, and not have some sort of familiarity with the things that sort of infect the quote-unquote underclass. And what I mean to say by that is not, you know, so much the stuff seeps over, but you're gonna go to school with people who are poor. You're gonna have friends who are poor. You may have cousins who are poor. I mean, just as an example, you know, as I say, I grew up, you know, pretty well provided for. My 2 older sisters, and I always find this interesting, my 2 older sisters and Big Bill spent their early life in the projects with, you know, my father and their mother. You know, so these things sort of shift and, you know, and change, but we have so much proximity to those sorts of issues. And I think that's another thing that's different.
Well, you had a really unusual family in many ways. I mean, not maybe just that your father and your mother were not as poor as the folks around them. They had jobs, and they also took education very seriously, which we'll talk about. But first, you say in the book that when... Now, I knew Baltimore before the crack epidemic. When I was there, even though it was very segregated, I lived in a segregated community. I taught at Baltimore Community College, and I had students who worked at Bethlehem Steel and African American workers as well as white workers. They made a good living.
Mm-hmm.
You say when crack hit Baltimore, civilization fell.
Indeed.
So
indeed.
Give us the before and after.
Well, and you have to remember, I was probably about 10 or 11 when crack hit. So my memory of the before is not so much a memory as it is a sensibility. And it's also melded with the whole idea of just getting older and things changing, you know, and the sort of chaos that comes about from just becoming an adolescent. But, you know, my, you know, recollection to the extent that I have one, and, you know, the recollection of folks that I interviewed for the book is that there were just laws. I mean, it was just much more stable. You could go to the skating rink and you could go bowling and you could do things like this. And you didn't hear about people getting shot. I mean, there was always violence, but what crack brought was a sort of catastrophic violence. Not, you know, I got beat up, but I got killed You know what I mean? Because I stepped on somebody's suede pumas. I said in the book, you know, a misstep on somebody's suede pumas and the jihad begins. I mean, it was the sort of catastrophic violence that crack brought that was just shocking. It just completely altered the dynamic in Baltimore and I think in cities around the country.
What did you say? A misstep on somebody's what?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a line in the book. A misstep onto suede pumas. Suede, you know, they're all these sort of little intricate phrases in the book that come from the era. And suede pumas were a shoe, you know, just normal Puma tennis shoes, and they were they had a line that were completely made out of suede. And they were very popular at the time. And if you stepped on, like the big thing back then, people would get shot for stepping on somebody's shoes. It was seen as, you know, great disrespect for whatever reason. And because they were suede, if you stepped on somebody's shoes, they could be, the footprint was easily seen. And so there would be all these stories about people stepping on somebody else's suede pumas by mistake and somebody shooting someone else. And I think, you know, a huge part of that is that these people, you know, you're young and you're a boy and you're going through all of the sort of, you know, hormonal and, you know, just sociological thing that boys go through about aggression and that sort of thing. And suddenly you have access to guns. You know, you have access to guns. You may not have the sort of family background to stabilize you and to steer you through that, and then suddenly there's a gun right there. And I think, you know, that just breeds trouble. It just breeds complete trouble.
And we're speaking with Ta-Nehisi Coates about his memoir, The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. So now let's talk about your father, about your dad. He was a really unusual man, a member of the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was.
And an intellectual. Talk about the forces that made him who he was.
Well, my dad was a very smart child. He was an extremely intelligent child, learned to read at a very early age. And he was raised in an environment in which it's not so much that intelligence wasn't prized, but the social infrastructure was not there for people to know, I think, what to do with intelligent children. For instance, he talks in the book about how he had no concept that he could one day go on to college, like that was what smart kids actually did. But he was a smart kid, grew up, you know, in extreme poverty in North and West Philadelphia, and went on entered the Army, became, you know, went off to the Vietnam War, mostly because there really wasn't anything else. Again, I mean, college wasn't really something that he, you know, saw as a prospect for himself. Got radicalized in the Army. Came out. Was a member of the Black Panther Party for some period of time. Became disillusioned with that at a point where a lot of people became disillusioned with it. And, you know, went back to something that he had always loved as a child and continued to love all his life. And that was books. He owned a bookstore for a little while. He eventually moved into publishing books, reprints, and moved into republishing books that were out of print, buying about African Americans. And that really is his business even to this day. My dad loved and loves books. And so that was just a huge influence on me. It was, one of the first sort of initial, how shall I say, it primed me to be a lover of words. I got that from him very much.
And he named you this very unusual name, Ta-Nehisi.
Yes, he did.
Tell us what that's about.
Ta-Nehisi is a geographical reference to ancient Egyptian for the Nubians who lived to the south of Egypt. And my dad was just particularly struck by that name. He just loved it, and he gave it to me.
And the Nubians were the black Egyptians.
Yes. Or not quite, I guess not. Egyptians at certain points when they moved into Egypt, but literally, a kingdom in and of their own right.
As we said at the beginning of this segment, Ta-Nehisi Coates has just published a book that's a kind of letter to his son. It's called Between the World and Me. But in The Beautiful Struggle, he writes extensively and movingly about his own father. He gave you his love of books, and he was a tough taskmaster. Tell us about that, and why was he like that?
Well, my dad had five sons and two daughters. And, you know, fathers worry about their daughters, I think. But, you know, and my dad worried about his daughters. But I think my dad really, really worried about his sons. Because, again, the period in which we were coming up in was a period of great catastrophic violence. The catastrophe for women in that period was a teen pregnancy. But, you know, teen pregnancy, you know, as bad as it was, I'm not trying to in any way diminish teen pregnancy as a problem, but maybe you could go back to school still. you know, it was going to cripple you, but maybe you could get a job. There were, you know, different things that you could do. The things that were happening to black boys were just fine. I mean, you go off to jail, and that is like a completely, it just alters everything. You're going to have trouble getting employed when you get out. You're going to have trouble going back to school, getting financial aid. Or you might just get shot. You know what I mean? Like, you might literally end up dead. So I think those sorts of fears pushed my father. I mean, it really, really pushed him to make sure he was really on the ball when it came to his kids. And so in some ways, strict is the wrong word to describe my father, because in many ways, we were quite liberated. I was allowed to hang out with whoever I wanted to. I didn't have any sort of curfew for, you know, when I could talk on the phone. My father never policed what I read or what I listened to. But what he did do was he made his force felt on things that he felt he should. So, for instance, we didn't celebrate any holidays. And so, you know, for quote-unquote conscious black people coming up during that period of time, the idea was that, oh, if you don't celebrate Christmas, you don't celebrate Kwanzaa. But we didn't even celebrate Kwanzaa.
And why was that?
Because my dad didn't see it as any more legitimate. He saw it as just a fake Christmas for people who, you know, couldn't deal with the fact that they weren't celebrating Christmas.
I'm speaking with Ta-Nehisi Coates about his memoir, The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood. So he was part of part of the counterculture, and part of that counterculture was also the Black Power movement, the Black Panthers, and yet it was something, I mean, he was part of the 60s generation.
He was, except he was a counterculture within the counterculture. You know, like, because like I said, I mean, for people like him, the standard thing was, I don't celebrate, at least for black folks, I don't celebrate Christmas, I celebrate Kwanzaa. And he was like, no, I don't do that either. You know, so even, you know, he was not even a doctrinaire counterculture person. I mean, one of the reasons why, you know, he was in the Panther Party and ended up leaving, you know, because he didn't like what he saw. It wasn't so much that he, like, became a conservative or something like that. I mean, he still believed what he believed, but, you know, my dad is an iconoclast. And so he pulls from a lot of different places, loves to debate, loves to, you know, argue and go back and forth, is always turning things over in his head. And so even as, you know, certainly as part of the counterculture, you know, there was nothing doctrinaire about him at all. More than anything, he treasured free thinking, has always treasured free thinking. And so I think what he wanted for us, more than that we agree with him, was that, you know, we be thinking individuals. You know, that I think was his highest aspiration for us.
And how was that for you? Now, you also had a family in which there was not just free thinking, but a certain amount of free loving, as you say. He had, you know, 7 kids by 4 different women.
Yes.
How was that aspect of his iconoclasm for you in growing up?
See, it didn't really strike me that way because most of that, A, happened before I was born. So, like, I wasn't around. Like, I knew it, but I'm coming of age in a community in which I would say the majority of my friends don't have fathers at all. So it wasn't like, you know, next door was the Waltons. You know what I mean? Next door were people living with their grandmother, living with an aunt. You know, father comes around every 3 years or something like that. So from my perspective, I thought, you know, what we were doing was, you know, probably healthier than most of what I was seeing in the community.
And yet he did have a girlfriend live with you and your mother.
Oh, she did not live with us.
Oh, that's right.
She did not live with us. But yes, you do. Now you're giving away the book. That's the only reason why I wasn't saying that.
We don't have to do that.
No, you can do it. No, it's fine. It's fine. It's totally, I'm willing to. But yeah, he did. He did. And that's you know, a point of tension in the book. But even that, you know, I was raised in such a way that it was like, my dad is my dad. He's not my husband. My mom is my mom. She's not my wife. So, you know, whatever relationship they have between each other, whatever issues they have, you know, like, that's not my issue. You know, my issue is dealing with them, you know, as parents. And that was how I always, thought about it.
And there was a lot of love, too. I mean, it sounds like you had some of the advantages of having multiple adults and half-siblings around.
I did. I mean, I think, again, if this is something that one thing that black kids don't get enough of, and probably kids in general, you know, that it takes a village thing, as corny as it sounds. It's just true. I mean, the more responsible, positive adults you can surround your child with, who can impute expectations on your child tell him or her that, you know, you're expected to, you know, go out in the world and do beautiful things. That is a great thing for children to hear. And I had that from everywhere. It just came from all sorts of sources.
Now, your dad became a librarian at Howard University,
mm-hmm.
where your older brother and sister also went to school there. And there, your parents' expectations of you were quite high academically. As you say, you got your love of words there, and you're a journalist now. But you had a kind of rocky, ambivalent relationship to school.
Yeah, always had, always have, probably always will have. I wasn't very good at school. I was pretty smart. But I, you know, when it came down to sitting in a seat and listening to somebody for 40 minutes, and I just, my mind wasn't there. I was too easily distracted, still am too easily distracted. And I performed quite poorly. Somehow, you know, my parents dragged me, across the finish line into college. But I've always performed quite poorly in school.
On page 169, you talk about there's a sense of the adults around you who are watching you and worrying about your academic achievement here. You say they knew that you were smart, and yet whenever someone threatened to put a grade on it, you say, I fell asleep and lost interest. So I'd like you to read the next paragraph, and in this, you're talking about your older brother as well as yourself.
In this, Big Bill and I were one. Our folks understood that there was a war upon us and that school was a weapon that outdid any Glock. Yet the whole process, with its equally spaced desks, precisely timed periods and lectures, with its standardized pencils and tests, felt unnatural to me. But much as I hated their terms, having been impressed into them, I hated more the failing. So I was left with great unconscious sadness and emptiness, which even when I was alone, I was not fully aware. But it worked on me like an invisible weight, altered my laughter, posture, my approach to girls. Forget what you have heard or what you have seen in your son. He may lie about homework and laugh when the teacher calls home. He may curse his teacher, propose arson for the whole public school system. But inside is the same sense that was in me. None of us ever want to fail. None of us ever want to be unworthy, to not measure up.
Yeah, that weight, that unconscious sadness. I wonder if that's something that not only you experienced, but that you also saw not only in you and your big brother, Bill, but also in the boys around you. There's been a big debate, I think, in the African-American community, and that, you know, certainly been witnessed by, you know, the rest of America around, you know, do African-American kids care about school?
Yeah, I think that's poppycock. And, I think if you're a smart kid, right, and you're a young black kid and you're smart, you get teased, like all smart kids get teased, especially if you're smart and socially awkward, you know, smart, socially awkward, which sometimes, you know, goes hand in hand. Mm-hmm. You get teased, and I got teased. But that's sort of based on this mythical parallel world wherein white, smart, socially awkward kids are like class president and captain of the football team. In the real world, you know, smart, socially awkward kids get teased. I didn't know anybody who, if you talk to them and they were like, you know, are you happy you failed? They would say yes. People make decisions for all sorts of reasons. Wanting to fail, though, it's just sort of, you know, we get to say things about black kids because usually there are no black kids around to talk for themselves or to be, you know, interviewed that, you know, are just completely ludicrous. And that was one of the things I wanted to do in this book. You know what I mean? Black kids don't, you know, want to fail. You know, that doesn't mean that, you know, school should be made any easier for them. But if you begin with the presumption that they, you know, don't care about school, then, you know, there's really nothing else to talk about. You know, it's just a way of shutting down the conversation. I mean, what else can you say? I mean, it's on them then. You know, and I find it preposterous to look at children, you know, and to draw those sorts of, you know, conclusions. It's deeply dehumanizing and flattening and just sort of reflects, I think, a general frustration that adults may feel. But one of the things that I'm clear on is I remember being a kid, and I remember, you know, what I did, and I remember my motivations. And so I've decided that I'm going to carry that with me throughout my life when I decide to talk about children and when I'm speaking on how children are. I'm going to remember how I was as a child. I did bad at school, and I failed quite a bit, but you could not say that I didn't care. I mean, it's the only thing I really had to draw my self-esteem from. And so it actually did great injury to do bad at school. So I hate that whole line of thinking.
So is there something there then about the difference in expectations? That is, that the society in some way expects black kids to fail, and then they do.
Well, so first of all, I think most black kids, you know, if you just go across the board, have less access to wealth. So you begin there. And so parents are much more harried and thinking about other things. Okay, so you start there. Second, a significant portion of black kids do not have fathers. They just don't. And, you know, you can go back and debate on the gender politics of this, but the fact of the matter is raising kids is an extremely difficult job. And so raising one with a single parent is hard enough. When you start getting into two, three, four, and there's really only one parent there on a day-to-day basis, you're going to have trouble. And, you know, I'm, as you can, you know, see, quite progressive on some of this stuff. But, I mean, it's just, it's no getting away from the fact that it begins with parents. It really does. I mean, we have all of these debates about schools and, you know, what are schools doing and what do schools need to do more. And I just, schools are left to deal with situations that arise from all of the time a kid spends, you know, away from school. And so how you, you know, address that and, you know, put school in isolation of everything else that's happening in a community, in a family, you know, I don't know how you do that.
Yeah, and yet in your book, I think your book, The Beautiful Struggle, really explores in a very moving way how your family was able to do that. I mean, you had some gifts in your family, but you also had some tremendous struggles. And so it does also come down to some sense to the individual.
It does. And then there's the other thing, you know. I mean, for me, it's very structural. I know I had quite a bit of support, and I don't know where I would be had I, say, been adopted. But my dad comes from a completely different situation where he didn't have a level of family support I had. So I just marvel at who he is. So, you know, yeah, some of that also comes down to, you know, put your foot on the gas and do it. You know, that definitely does play a role in that. But I don't want it simplified. You know, it's not one thing. It's about 50 things working at the same time. And the other thing that people have to remember is basically until the mid-1960s, African Americans really weren't citizens of this country in full. And, you know, you're talking about a legacy of not, I mean, let's just put slavery aside. You're talking about Jim Crow. I mean, you're talking about covenant, you know, housing covenants. You're talking about housing discrimination. You're talking about redlining. That is basically, you know, a state-sponsored transfer of wealth out of the black community. And so we've been out of that for, you know, what do you say, maybe 30, 35 years, and we expect basically a century's worth of damage to be healed in 30, 35 years. You know, at a point when no one is really interested in healing that damage and, you know, hasn't really been for some time. It's going to, you know, and I'm an optimist. I'm not saying that to be pessimistic. You know, I think African Americans have made great strides, but this is going to take time. It doesn't happen overnight.
Ta-Nehisi Coates in 2008, talking about his memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.